there, everybody. It is Wednesday, August 1st, 2012, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. So much ground to cover on this week's episode. Hey, first guest, are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
Let me introduce you. The Reverend Dr. R. Scott Colglazier is the author of several books, including Finding a Faith That Makes Sense, Circling the Divine, Touchstones, Yes to Peace, and his best-selling Christmas book, A Winter Name for God. His most recent book is titled A Dictionary of Faith for Open-Hearted and Open-Minded People. He is also the author of the popular spirituality blog Take a Breath. His work as a religious leader has been featured on CNN, The Today Show, CBS This Morning. He also passes the time, you know, every now and then, as the senior minister of the First Congregational Church of Los Angeles, the oldest Protestant church in the city of LA, which just became home to the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles, which we're going to talk all about. Reverend Colglazier, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
I am so glad to be a guest on your show. Thank you for inviting me.
We are so happy to have you. So let's start off easy for you. We'll start off easy. In 10 words or less, how can I become more open-hearted and open-minded?
Absolutely. I think the open-hearted journey is when we open ourselves to who we really are and what we really feel, and we do the same toward other people. When that happens, there's always something absolutely magical and spiritual about it.
Done. I can do that, right?
You can do it.
I can pull that off. Even a gay Jew from New Jersey can pull that off.
Absolutely.
Okay, I get worried. I get worried sometimes. All right, well, before we talk about all the fun things happening, let's go back a little bit and give people a sense of you. How would you go about describing your spiritual journey?
Thank you for that. You know, my journey has been one of, like a lot of people, you know, I grew up in a church context growing up and went to church and that sort of thing. And I had an interest in religion and spirituality, went on to graduate school, seminary. But it was really after seminary that I think of my spiritual journey really becoming engaged, mm-hmm. for me at least. One of the most pivotal moments was when I went to California many years ago now, and I did a workshop at the Esalen Institute. And I did a workshop with a man by the name of Brother David Steindl-Rast.
Okay.
And Brother David has created a whole network around the theme of gratitude. And I did a workshop titled Rediscovering Your Own Myth. And it was at that point that I began to realize that the spiritual journey was not about following in the steps of my father or my mother, not following in the steps of my religion or my church, but it was a deeply personal journey. All of those things can contribute to it, but it is my myth and my unique experience. And for me, at least, that was a real turning point.
Yeah. For folks that haven't been, and I want to touch on, because last year, last October, I almost said I did some time at Esalen. That sounds so prison-like. It's not really very prison-like, is it?
It's not a prison. It's actually very liberating. Esalen is not for everybody, and I want to quickly add that. But for those people who are really ready for a new kind of adventure into awareness and consciousness, it's a wonderful place. Esalen was founded many years ago now, but it was really on the forefront of what was called the human potential movement in the 1960s and 70s. They're doing lots of different things now, but in many ways they've kept true to that aim, and it is helping people rediscover what it means to be a human being, and that's the spiritual journey.
I'm not going to lie. I got my tail kicked a little bit by the facilitator of my workshop.
Ooh.
Mary Goldenson. Shout out to Mary Goldenson, who she called me out on some stuff, so I'm still recovering from that. But not bad scenery. Not bad scenery there in Big Sur.
Great scenery when you're perched in Big Sur and the mountains are behind you and the ocean is in front of you. It is the Garden of Eden.
When Mary Goldenson is kicking your tail, you need some good scenery there. I'm just putting that out there. All right, so now how do you make the adjustment? So you have this spiritual journey and you're deciding, you know what, I think I could actually lead a congregation.
Well, yes, in a way it's not a great jump. Some days it feels like a great jump.
Okay.
But most of the time it's really about recognizing that every human being, whether they go to church or go to a synagogue, whatever, everybody is on a journey. And so part of what I do as a religious leader is that I'm really trying to help people move into that journey to understand themselves better, to understand their neighbor better. And, you know, really in the end, religion is about helping people navigate between two unalterable facts. One, we were born and we're going to die.
Okay.
And how do we find meaning in between those two poles? That's what it's about. And in a way, I think religion can really help on that journey.
Now, you've led some very different congregations, I assume. I'm making a geographical assumption that a congregation in Fort Worth, Texas is very different from New York City, which is very different than Los Angeles. Is that correct?
Every place is different. There's no doubt about it. You know, Fort Worth, of course, that was sort of on the buckle of the Bible Belt, and that had its challenges. And yet, what I found there is that people were really interested in finding a perspective of the Christian faith that was more open, that was more progressive, that was less judgmental. And so I feel like people really resonated with what I was about there. Whereas the Riverside Church in New York when I was there and here in Los Angeles, it's the beginning place is a different place. In some ways, the place that people begin here is, you know, religion is bad, I want to stay away from it, and yet people have some interest. And so you begin helping people see that there's good religion and bad religion, and in fact, good religion can be very good.
Yeah. One of the best aspects of this show, and where I'm so appreciative, is that we've had so many spiritual leaders on the show in the past 4 years, and I never tire of the question, even as people say, oh, it's such a basic question, but it clearly still needs to be asked. So many of your brethren out there are saying, no, you can't be gay.
Right.
It's not consistent. And again, this isn't a very nuanced question because it's not a very nuanced argument. There are people out there saying, look, your sexual orientation is not compatible with your religious beliefs.
Yeah, and there's still a lot of that out there, and there's a whole lot more of it that I'm just concerned about, obviously, and I cringe every time I hear that kind of thing. But what I'm also finding is that it feels like there is a new day really trying to dawn here. And what I can at least speak for Los Angeles and our congregation here. People who are gay, or they come to our congregation, and what they find is a real sense of openness, a real sense of welcome.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, they're not necessarily looking for a gay church or a church that talks about sexual orientation every week. They're looking for real community, real welcome, real acceptance, and I think they're finding that here. And so, you know, on the one hand, I know there's a lot of negative kinds of things out there in the name of God, especially toward gay people, but there are some real positive things happening around the country, and I think one of them is First Church here in Los Angeles.
Well, I would say so, because as I mentioned in the intro, you all just made quite the move in welcoming the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles. How did that come about?
We are thrilled to welcome them to our congregation and to our building. It really happened because they wanted a place for a concert back in the spring, and so we had booked that concert, and they did three performances, one on Saturday night, one on Sunday afternoon, and another on Sunday night. The place was absolutely packed.
Nice.
It was just a fantastic experience. But one of the things that I did before every concert, I brought a welcome to everybody who was gathered there. And I said to them, you know, we all know that not all churches are created equal. And I wanted people to know that this is a church. We open our doors as wide as we possibly can. And when you walk in, you are in a place of welcome and acceptance. And we believe you to be a child of God. The place erupted in applause.
Oh.
It was such an affirming thing. And for many of the men singing in the chorus, for them to be back in this church, or back in a church period, was a challenging thing because they have had so many difficult experiences throughout their history, and yet to be here was also very healing. And so it was just the perfect match. And then we started talking. Well, you know, they were looking for a new home. We said, we think we could be that for you, and we worked it out, and we were able to announce that just a few weeks ago. And so it's a great partnership, and we're really looking forward to it.
Now, I've seen many times the movie Sister Act, which I believe is a documentary, so it's my understanding that they will now bring more congregants in for you.
you know, we'll see what happens. You know, I want it to be very clear. You know, we didn't welcome the chorus in order to get more members.
Right.
We welcome this chorus because it's the right thing to do. It's a good thing to do. If we get more people who are part of our church community, fantastic. The door's wide open. But I want to be clear, there wasn't not an ulterior motive here. Our motive was simply, this is a church that's had a great musical history. The Gay Men's Chorus has a great musical history, and it was just a perfect match for us.
And it's my understanding, tell me if I'm wrong, that there's quite the organ there in the church.
Absolutely. We're home to the world's largest church pipe organ.
Look at that.
So it is fantastic. Also home to the Los Angeles Bach Festival. And so, you know, this musical heritage that we have in this place, opening our doors and making a connection with the Gay Men's Chorus, it just really made sense.
Have you played the organ?
No.
What?
They keep me away from it.
No, that can't possibly be true.
I look at it, yes. I think about it, but no touching.
Have you not told them who you are?
You know, I'm the senior minister, but when it comes to the great organs of First Church, it's all hands off.
Wow. I was going to say, you can throw that title around, but...
Yeah, well, as you know, titles mean what?
Absolutely nothing. Please tell my students that, except they already know. So any resistance at all? Did anybody step forward and say, you know what, this might not be the best idea for us at this time?
You know, if there has been resistance, I've not heard about it. I've announced it. I processed it with our trustees before we finalized this partnership. And they were very open.
Great.
And it's been an interesting, we're at an interesting point in our history. I think for many years we've had people who were gay and lesbian part of our church community, but nobody really said much about it. Nobody articulated much in a public way. But a year or so ago, actually on the MLK weekend, I did a sermon entitled Civil Rights, Gay Rights, and God. And I basically tried to link the civil rights movement of the 60s to the gay rights movement of where we are today. And I will tell you, I've been here now going on 5 years, first time ever in my history here, people stood and gave a standing ovation.
Wow.
To a sermon. That told me that our church was ready to come out of the shadows and say, you know, this is who we are. We're ready to welcome all of God's children.
Look at that. That's beautiful.
It was a great experience. It really was.
So now this is an election year, and California is always a hotly contested state. It's a state that people want on their ballot.
They also want California money all the time.
Well, there's that as well.
The candidates are always coming around.
How do you address that intersection between religion and politics?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I'm getting ready to actually do an August sermon series on politics and God. And, you know, one of the things that I'm a strong believer in is the separation of church and state. And so I'm going to be talking about that because I think that's important. You know, we are a nation that has a very strong religious character. There's no doubt about that. And I think we can honor that and be open to that. But at the same time, we're not a nation that tries to demand that other people follow in our religious pathway. So,
So
I'm going to be talking about that, and I also hope that people will just be engaged as citizens and do so by exercising their right to vote, openness to the issues, and also I also hope that people who come from a faith community can do more and more to sort of lessen the polarization around a lot of our political issues right now.
Yeah. Very much so. Well, let's talk a little bit about youth. I know you are a proud grandfather.
I am. We have a granddaughter who's a year and a half old.
Oh, she's tiny.
She's tiny, but she's a lovely little girl. She's our sweet Caroline.
You like her.
I like her.
Well, let's talk about youth. What more can we do? What more can spiritual leaders, religious leaders do to assist, but in particular gay youth who continue to struggle, and many of whom continue to struggle again at that intersection of sexual orientation and religion?
Right. You know, I recall a conversation I had many years ago with Rabbi Harold Kushner. And we were having lunch one day, and we were just talking, and he said something really interesting. He said, you know, when religion is good, it's very good, but when it's bad, it's really, really bad.
Yeah.
And it's true. And I think that the one thing that people can do is to understand that not all religious communities are alike, there are religious communities out there that are open, they are affirming, they are accepting, they are warm, they are joyful places, and if people will just keep searching them out, they are in every city in the country, if people will search them out, those communities can really make a difference in the spiritual journey.
Nice. So there's more we can do.
There really is.
Okay. Now, this isn't a particularly gay question, but it's on my list and I have to ask you, what does Van Morrison have to tell us about faith?
Van Morrison. Van Morrison. He's into the mystic. He's stealing time with his quiet friend. He's heading up to Big Sur to find God and Eden and Avalon all together. So Van Morrison has everything to do with the spiritual journey.
Wow. I feel that even the Labrador Retrievers are looking at you a little funny right now.
They probably do.
Well, tell me about the nuts and bolts of, I'm fascinated by the idea of delivering a sermon every week. You said you're already working on August. Does that mean you already know what you're doing for this coming weekend?
Well, it means that I know what the topic is this coming weekend. But in terms of specifics, obviously, you kind of have to sit down and begin working on that. And so I was doing that yesterday. And so my process is that I try to plan ahead, at least in terms of what I think the topic is going to be, a sermon title might be on that Sunday, and maybe a little stream of consciousness paragraph to go with each sermon. But each week then, I really have to sit down and focus and say, okay, what do I really want to say? What do I really want to do? And it's not enough just to have something to say. Hopefully you say something that is also engaging and interesting and that connects with people. And so that's really the work of doing a sermon. And so in a way, it's sort of like writing an essay once a week. It's about an 8 to 10 page essay, and you do it in a way that hopefully is engaging.
Was there ever a sermon that you thought was, you know, fairly standard that ended up being a little bit controversial?
I think it's fair to say I've done several sermons that are on the controversial side.
Fun.
Because, you know, I really feel as if that, you know, to play it safe week after week after week, you know, I don't want to do that. And honestly, my congregation doesn't want me to do that.
Right.
They want to be engaged with what's happening in their lives in the real world. And, you know, in a way, you know, religion and theology is about making contact with the real world. And so I try to do that. You know, some sermons are a little more on the pastoral side of things. Some sermons are a little more on the social issues, justice side of things. Some are more inspirational. Some are a little more didactic and teaching. But hopefully, over the course of the year, you give your congregation something that really makes a difference in their lives.
That's fantastic. I can't imagine. I think I would run out of sermons after a couple weeks, but you just keep going.
I'm going to tell you, I think that you could give a sermon, and I'm going to open the door to you. The next time you're in Los Angeles, you have my pulpit, okay?
Wow.
Wow, yeah. Think about that.
How would you advertise that? The gay Jew is going to stand up here and everyone would listen?
I think they would listen.
Okay.
Absolutely. And I might like introduce it. And then, you know, when you're finished, I'll kind of clean up the presentation.
Look how well I've taught you. It's like we've learned this together.
Well, it's like in November, for example, we've been doing this trilogue event that is become just a great event for us. I have a rabbi who joins me in the pulpit, and I also have an Islamic imam who
joins fantastic.
Me. And those are great kinds of trilogue events. I'm also going to be doing something around Jesus and Buddha this fall, and we have some Japanese drummers, and they're just going to blow the roof off of our sanctuary. It's going to be fantastic.
So what you're saying is it's perhaps not the most traditional stagnant service that you're running there in Los Angeles.
Well, it's really interesting because if you walked into our service on a Sunday, you would think this is a very traditional, almost Episcopal-like church. On the other hand, what we've been doing more and more is engaging these sort of splashes of color and splashes of differences and innovation in the service, and people are really loving it. The traditional means more when you have a little something non-traditional in the service. So I think it's going well, and we're really pleased about this.
I love it. I love it. And there is a sense that I'm sure that you have to keep evolving, that you have to keep appealing to different people.
You really do. And there's something good about having certain things in a service that you do week after week. That's great. Those rituals are important, and I'm happy with those. But I also think it's great when you have something in a service that surprises people.
Yeah.
And the surprise is often where we experience the grace and magic and goodness of it all.
Oh, we all need more grace and magic and goodness.
We really do.
We really do. Well, I do want to talk about one of your other pursuits too, because I know that you've worked with one of our favorite organizations, Planned Parenthood, which has had quite the year this year, in the media, and just a great friend to the LGBT community at Planned Parenthood. Why is that a particular organization that you have been involved?
You know, I really love the organization, and I've been a part of their organization in various ways throughout my ministerial career, but for me at least, you know, what they're doing should never be politicized.
Mm-hmm.
What they are doing, they are really trying to help women, and not just women, it's also men who are involved too, but they're really trying to help women make important decisions and have good options about their life. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. In fact, there's everything right with that. And so I feel good about what they're doing, and you know, I feel like the president this last year, she really led the organization to a new level in the face of some of the criticism and manipulation that was going on with their message.
Yeah. They do good work.
They really do good work. And it's not theoretical work. It's not like work that is sort of an issue kind of thing. It's real work with real women who have real decisions to make.
Love
That's
it.
Where it meets the road right there.
Love it. Well, one of our favorite topics on this show is, of course, Broadway. You guys are doing a little Broadway event there at the church.
We are. Oh, yes. We have this marvelous choir. And so every summer we have an evening where they do Broadway on the forecourt. And we have this large space in front of the sanctuary. And so people bring their picnic dinners and bottles of wine and sit around, and they are absolutely carried away and serenaded by this choir when they do a lot of Broadway numbers. It's just a fun thing. It's a fellowship thing, and it's a music thing. So how can you go wrong with
that?
I
love it. I love it. Anything else coming up that everyone should know about?
Well, you know, I just want to encourage people to take a look at our website.
Yeah.
Because that is a great source of information. It's www.fccla.org. And you can just see what's coming up in the life of this church. And you know, anybody who has friends in Los Angeles, tell them to give us a try, because there's something special happening in this congregation right now.
And that's not just when I'm up there giving my sermon.
Thank you.
It's other days, too.
The door's wide open.
I'm telling you, I'm in L.A. every summer. You're going to...
I'm going to meet you. It's going to happen. I feel it. I feel it already.
Oh, my dad's going to be so excited to see that on YouTube.
It will be awesome.
Well, look, the voice that you are providing on behalf of the community is just huge. It's just huge. The world can never have a shortage of allies. And to have an ally that is in a particular section of our community with religion and faith that so many people assume, well, that part is just not accessible to us. And to have people like you who are standing up and saying, no, those are not incompatible concepts. You can lead a very full life that has spirituality, that has religion, that incorporates in being LGBT, and just feel this sense of community. I hope you know what an important voice that ally voice is for the entire community.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that. And I guess the way I would frame it is that, you know, when we open our hearts and lives to other people, and people who may be different from us or come from a different background or different experiences from us, our lives are always enriched when we are able to welcome others. That's really what church is about. That's really what faith is about, or at least it should be. And I'm really glad to play maybe a small part.
Oh, I think it's bigger than small. It'll get even bigger next summer when I deliver my first sermon there at the First Congregational Church of LA. But
I cannot wait.
Reverend, what an absolute pleasure having you on the show. All the best to the dogs. We know we love them too.
Oh, the dogs, Lily and Gracie. They're my muses and my little angels. One's black, one's white. Racial harmony. And so we love them to pieces.
And on that note, Reverend, an absolute pleasure. Please keep doing what you're doing. It makes such a huge difference.
Thank you so much, and good luck to you too.
All the best.
Blessings. Bye-bye.
Hey, where did we go? Days when the rains came. Down in the hollow. Playing a new game. Laughing and running. Hey, hey. Skip laughing and jumping in the misty morning fog with our hearts thumping and you, my brown-eyed girl.
All right, folks, and we are back. Let's keep the good times rolling. Hey, Russell, are you ready to go?
I am ready to go.
Let me introduce you. Russell Roybal is the Deputy Executive Director of External Relations for the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. He's also the Director of Movement Building for the Task Force, where he oversees the organization's capacity building and leadership development efforts. He's the Chair of the Board of Grassroots Institute for Fundraising Training. He's previously been selected as a Fellow in the Rockwood Leadership Program, and he even has a video series on fundraising called Ready, Set, Raise. Russell, welcome to this show, It's So Gay.
Well, thank you so much, Ken. I'm so excited to be here, especially with a show that really is after my little gay heart.
Hey, look at that. Is your little gay heart just so gay?
I am so gay.
Well, then,
when I told people I was coming on the show, they were like, oh my God, that's the perfect show for you.
Well, good. Then we have a lot to talk about, I suspect. Well, let's start from the basics. Not that our listeners don't know, but just to be clear, describe for us the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, in particular how it differs from some other national organizations out there.
Sure. Well, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force is the United States' oldest and first national LGBT civil rights organization, founded in 1973. We've been around the longest, and we work primarily at the grassroots level to build power, take action, and create change. So we really work alongside, shoulder to shoulder, with local and statewide activists to not only pass pro-gay legislation, but also to beat back anti-gay legislation. We also train leaders and activists at our annual Creating Change Conference, which a lot of folks come to from around the country. Our next one is going to be our 25th conference, and it's going to be in the beautiful city of Atlanta, Georgia, January 23rd through 27th. Not only do we fight side by side with activists on the ground at the grassroots level, but we also teach folks how to win at the ballot box and how to make sure that they are doing the things necessary to move equality forward in their towns and cities across the United States.
Well, let's pretend for a second that I am perhaps a deputy executive director of external relations. What the heck would my day look like?
Every day is different here at the task force. I often tell people, I was actually just having this conversation this past week with a former colleague of mine, and I think I have the best job in the whole world.
Awesome.
Not only do I get to work for an amazing organization that is the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, but I get to come to work every day and, not only fight for my rights, but fight for the rights of so many folks that I care about, and that I want to live in a world free from persecution, prosecution, and punishment of LGBT people. And so that's what I come to work every day to do. And so I think I have a great job. So my daily routine here is I get to oversee all of the fundraising of the organization, all of our communications work, and our annual conference, Creating Change. So every day is different for me here at the task force.
Well, let's talk about fundraising first. How, Russell, do we put the fun in fundraising?
Well, that
I heard that's a specialty of yours.
Yeah, fundraising can be a little bit boring and mundane, but it's not like rocket science, right? You don't need to go to school for years on end in order to be a good fundraiser. But so many people are afraid of asking for money because they may have a weird relationship with it. We're taught all of these things growing up, how money is not necessarily a good thing and we're not supposed to talk about it. One of the things that I love to do is to get to make fundraising real for people and show them that they can do it and that, it's hard work, but like I said, it's not rocket science and that, especially when you're raising money for things that you're passionate about, that you care about, it's a really easy prospect to raise that money because, as my friend Kim Klein says all the time, we already know all the people we need to know to raise all the money we want to raise. We just haven't asked them. Mm. And so I get people to understand that they can ask their friends, neighbors, coworkers, family for money for their causes, and be able to really kind of determine the course that those kinds of organizations are going to take. So, I mean, the thing that I really love about raising money is I believe raising money is a political act, and I fundamentally believe in the redistribution of wealth because there are so many people that don't have anything. And so I feel like my job is to raise money from folks that have it and make sure that it gets to the causes that people care about and that I care about.
Well, we've actually been talking about fundraising for LGBT organizations a lot in the past couple months. Our good buddy Jimmy Nguyen had an article in The Advocate about how fundraising is becoming just more and more difficult, that giving in the LGBT and ally community is down these days, mm-hmm. that it's just not as high a level, obviously, as it possibly could be. What different strategies do you come up with to really appeal to everybody, especially because there are so many different organizations competing for the same dollars?
Well, I start with the belief that fundraising is about building relationships, and that it's really not necessarily about the transaction as much as it is about building a solid relationship with the folks that care about you and that you care about as an organization. So, you know, when I do fundraising trainings, in fact, when I'm done with this interview today, in an hour after it, I'm actually going to do a fundraising training at the LGBT Center here in New York City for folks that are writing in Cycle for the Cause, which raises money for the center's HIV-related programming, and I'm going to be working with riders today to get them excited about fundraising.
So. Well, wait a second. I have my ride, my Burlington to Portland ride, in less than 2 weeks. I need some strategies. Give me some tips.
Well, here's what I'm going to tell folks tonight is that often we think that we can't ask our friends or family for money, and so what I tell people is to ask permission to ask. So if folks know that you're really invested in something, it's really important to you, but you're a little bit afraid of asking them for a gift for what you're doing, in your case for your ride, then, you know, what I tell people to do is to ask permission to ask, which is have a conversation with your friend or family member that says, I'm really committed to this. I'm going to be riding from Portland to Burlington, and it's going to be long, and it's going to be might be a little bit challenging, but I'm really committed to do it because I believe in the cause that we're raising money for, and I want to ask you to support me in that, but I'm a little bit uncomfortable making sure that I'm not, you know, impinging on our relationship. Do you think it would be okay if we had that conversation about how you could support me in this effort? And I will guarantee you, most people are not going to say, no, I'm not going to talk to you about it. Right?
Is it okay if I just give you my list of people and you'll ask them? Because that's what I'm getting from all this.
Sure. You know what? I could probably find some call time and, you know.
Yeah, because it really strikes me reading your bio. You're just chock full of free time. So let's just add that on there. Now, what do you tell people about, because some people struggle and say, well, I'd rather give to a local organization than a national organization.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, I really believe that, you know, on average, people give to between 7 and 10 different organizations or causes. There are not a lot of people that only give to, you know, 2 or 3. A lot of people give to a lot. And a lot of folks that I work with around their fundraiser and even their giving, I tell them about taking inventory about what they're giving to. And a lot of people don't realize how much they're giving until they really think about it and add it up.
Yeah.
And if we were more strategic in our giving and giving to the things that matched our values, a lot of folks I work with will give to things that their parents gave to just because that's what they grew up with. But that may not match the values that they have currently. So it's part of it is kind of taking stock of, you know, what is important to you, and do your giving patterns match what's important to you? And if they don't, then that's a question that you need to ask yourself. And, you know, I give to organizations both on the local level and the national level. Certainly I give back to the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force where I work and who has invested a tremendous amount in me, especially when I was a young leader. Mm-hmm. One of the things I love about the task force is I went through its youth leadership training program many years ago. And
it was like 2 years ago, but yeah, go ahead.
I wish. But it really changed and transformed my life. And so not only do I get the pleasure of getting to work for the task force every day, but I also give back to it because I want to make sure that those opportunities are there for other young people. And so not only do I give on the national level, but I give and I support local organizations, like here in New York. I'm a donor to the center where I'm going tonight to teach folks how to raise some money. And then I also give to the San Diego LGBT Center where I used to live and where I went to school and where I had my first job, as a professional homosexual.
Nice.
Many years ago. And so, but I think it's important to do a mix of national and local, but the most important thing is to invest in the things that you care about and that you're passionate about and that you know are working on your behalf and that are using the resources that you're giving them wisely and putting them to good use. So it's important to have relationships with the organizations that you give money to. And, you know, for in my case, as a person who actively raises money all the time, to make sure that I am building really solid, genuine relationships with the donors at every level, whether they're giving a dollar or they're giving $1 million. Each one deserves my time and respect and a way to build a relationship with the organization.
Well, now pull back the curtain for me a little bit. My assumption is that all of the organizations are not coordinating when their emails go out, correct?
That's right.
So is there ever a time, this is what I picture, that Ray sends out an email and then another email comes out from another organization and she shakes her fist in the air and says, damn you, other LGBT organization. I mean, the timing of them is so insane where they come so close to each other. And I'm always thinking, oh, I wish they hadn't come right next to each other.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, in the space that we occupy, certainly, you know, there are lots of different organizations who have lots of different perspective on a particular issue. This is especially true when there's like, you know, something hot that's going to come out, like a court ruling or a vote or something like that. And so, you know, there can tend to be a little bit of a pileup, of, you know, folks who give to multiple organizations and get, you know, one email after the other. And, you know, we try actually not to send a ton of email because we don't want to fatigue our list, and we don't want people to not, you know, say, oh, here's another email from the task force. I'm just going to delete it. I'm not even going to read it. So we try to be really intentional when we send stuff to our full list, and we try to be much more targeted. You know, we have we segment our list so that there are folks who we consider kind of frontline activists that we know when we send them something are going to respond to it or going to send a note to their legislator or sign a petition or something like that. They're going to take more actions than folks who maybe only want to get our newsletter, our electronic newsletter once a month. So, you know, it's really incumbent upon the organization to know its list and to make sure that it is not abusing the contact that we have with folks, but to make sure that we're getting them the information they need and giving them the opportunities to be able to support our work.
I'm not going to lie. I will give more if I could get a picture of Ray shaking her fist in the air, damning another organization. I'm just saying. My giving will increase.
I'll ask her about that. Maybe we can get her to – maybe we'll do a little video with her shaking her fist.
My giving will increase. Whether it's a dollar or a million, I'm just saying. It will go up. All right, well, we have so much else to talk about. Now, I was just watching a YouTube video of you talking about, and it's really important that we cover this, the National Transgender Discrimination Survey. I mean, we have to give more time to all issues transgender because we're just not really doing it as a national media. Talk to us about that survey.
Sure. The survey was groundbreaking, the largest ever survey of the transgender community, over 6,500 respondents. More than we planned for or anticipated. We were grateful that so many folks took the time to fill out the survey because the instrument itself was hard to get through. It was, you know, over 50 questions and took, you know, a decent amount of time to answer and to think about. But it has provided us with such a wealth and richness of data, on the transgender community in ways that we're still, you know, finding kind of nuggets of information as we comb through and mine the data. You know, a couple of the kind of key findings in the data was, number one, some of the heartbreaking discrimination that transgender people face in their daily lives. We titled the study Injustice at Every Turn because truly transgender people face injustice and are targets of discrimination in every part of their lives. A couple of the findings were, you know, one of the key findings was anti-transgender bias and combined with racism had a devastating impact on transgender and gender nonconforming people of color. You know, to a degree that really, you know, could be life-threatening for folks. The rate of suicide amongst the respondents was over 40%. You know, the national average is like 1.5%. So, you know, the fact that people are struggling so much around their gender identity and feel like the only recourse they have is to take their own lives is a terrible, terrible thing.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
It's something that all of us, you know, every lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and allied person needs to think about and to respond to. So the study has been great. We've actually now produced the study. Not only do we have the whole study, which people can download on our site at thetaskforce.org or go to endtransdiscriminationnow.org and download the study there. But we've also produced a couple of studies based upon race. So there now is a African-American version of the study. There is a Latina and Latino version of the study. And we just released the Asian Pacific Islander study last week, which take those particular subgroups and look at how they fare in terms of some of the questions. The other thing that I think is important to point out is that a lot of transgender and gender nonconforming folks have been harassed at work, have been harassed at school, in many cases physically assaulted at work and school because of their gender identity or expression. Mm-hmm. And so the you know, every time I present the data, I'm sure you saw in the videos, as I go through the data every time I present it, by the end of my presentation, I'm always very angry.
Yeah.
Because it is...
it's a healthy anger.
Yeah, it's a healthy anger. It's a healthy anger. But it is, you know, it just, for a segment of our population to be so targeted and discriminated against is something we should all be up in arms about.
Yeah. So there's perhaps more work to be done.
Yeah, a ton of work to
be done. A ton of work to be done.
We've not, you know, we have just scratched the surface. And I mean, like, one thing that I'll point out too is around ID documents. You know, so many of us take for granted that our IDs look like who we are and match our gender and all of that great stuff. But for a lot of transgender people, their identity documents don't match who they are,
right?
Or who they have become. And the struggle for folks to get their driver's license changed, to get their passports changed, although it has become easier in some places, it is still a difficult process. And, you know, to go and try to cash a check or to check into a hotel or rent a car and you get to the counter and your ID document doesn't match your gender presentation can be a very, you know, it can be an uncomfortable experience that folks should not have to go through just because there are so many obstacles to getting the proper ID document.
We have to come together on a community on this one and really work harder.
Sure.
We have to work harder. Well, let's switch gears a little bit more. The Creating Change Conference, which you've already referenced, I am quite frankly mortified and embarrassed to admit that as a college dean at this point in my career, I still have never been to Creating Change.
You have got to come.
I know. I'm a dean of students at a college working on these issues for how long, and I've never been. What does someone experience at Creating Change?
It is transformative. It is like no other space in our movement. You know, the one in Atlanta in January will be our 25th, so it's going to be a big year.
A little celebratory.
Yeah, real celebratory, 25 years of Creating Change. It is It is by far the most diverse and inclusive space in the LGBT movement. Every facet of our movement is represented there. Lots of young people, lots of older folks, lots of folks of color, lots of transgender and gender nonconforming people. This has become, the Creating Change has become like the must-do, the conference I have got to go to if I'm a grassroots leader or activist.
Yeah.
It is 5 days of workshops and plenary sessions and day-long institutes and networking events and socials and receptions, and it is just an amazing, amazing conference. The thing that I look forward to going to it every year, you know, I used to go to it before I worked at the task force, and now that I get to help run it, you know, it's an incredibly exhausting but incredibly amazing experience all at the same time.
And, yeah.
You know, there's a moment where I kind of sit in the ballroom now that I work at the task force before opening plenary, and I think to myself, I pinch myself because I can't believe I get to do that. It's an honor to be able to present this conference and this gathering for people. It really is like our movement's family reunion. It's the movement's town square where all ideas are welcome and discussed and debated, and it is a really great event, and if you have not been, Ken, you need to come.
I'm embarrassed.
Mark it on your calendar and bring some students with you.
Of course. No, do you know how many of my students have gone? So many of my students have gone, and I've never been. So that's something to work on.
I have a friend who's a director of student activities at the University of San Diego, and I have been after him to come. He's not come either, and so I told him that he is coming this year, and he is bringing students with him. In January, you know, the Creating Change was the birthplace of what's called the Campus Consortium, which
of course,
you know, all the folks who work in higher ed.
I was a member of the consortium for years. I'm one of their speakers of their speakers bureau, and I've never been. I will go. I will
gotta come, because you know, this is, I think it's going to be the 15th anniversary of the consortium.
Yeah,
this year. Yeah.
Well, let me just say that if I can somehow get a picture of Ray Carey with her fist in the air saying, "Damn you, Ken," then I'll go to Creating Change. So there's a couple different captions we can throw in to get me to do different things. I will do different things based on the caption. Just putting that out there. Now, let's have you address the one complaint that I've heard about Creating Change, and it is the same complaint that I hear about the San Francisco to LA AIDS ride, my own charity treks that I do, same complaint, that it's an amazing experience, but holy cow, is it difficult to transition back to the real world afterwards.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when you're in a space for 5 days where, you know, I like to call it, if the world were perfect, it would be creating change every day. The when you're in a space for 5 days where all of a sudden you're in the majority, and that the thing that I love about creating change, especially for when I get to see first timers come and watch their eyes light up, where, you know, the great thing about creating change is that it is a space where you can be whoever you want to be.
Yeah.
Without judgment, without being targeted for discrimination, without being persecuted, where you can be your full, beautiful, queer, or allied self, and that it'll be celebrated. And, you know, at the end of those 5 days, it is a little bit hard to kind of go back into the reality. We always stay, you know, an extra night to do cleanup in the strike and, you know, package everything up and send it back to our offices, and I, you know, Sunday night at the hotel is always hard because you're like, oh, where'd everybody go?
Come back.
Exactly. It is a little hard to kind of reinsert yourself into the real world. But, you know, the great thing is that the thing I look forward to every year creating change is that for me, it feels like a shot in the arm.
Yeah.
Right. Like when I am getting to the point where I'm like, oh, I don't know if I can do this anymore. It's so hard. And I go to Creating Change, and as soon as that conference is over, I'm like recharged, re-energized to recommit to the work and to work even harder than I did before. And I think a lot of people feel that way.
And Atlanta in January, that's not so bad.
That's not so bad. You know, we were in Minneapolis 2 years ago in January.
Yeah, that doesn't work for me.
Yeah, but Atlanta probably be a little bit warmer.
Okay, that'll be good.
Minneapolis was a great city to have the conference in.
Yeah. Oh no, I heard great things. I'll make it. I swear I'll make it.
You
I'll
better
make it out there.
Better.
I know. I know. Now, I don't know if you guys heard over there at the task force, but this year, 2012, is actually an election year.
It is.
How
I heard something about that.
Yeah, is it? They covered it briefly there on the Huffington Post one day. How does your job change as someone who works in fundraising during an election year?
Well, you know,
or does it? Maybe I'm making an assumption.
I mean, I don't think it changes. I think that it, you know, a lot of times folks that give political dollars, it's separate from their charitable giving. You know, we not only raise charitable dollars at the task force, but our sister organization, the Task Force Action Fund, raises mm-hmm. political dollars. And so, you know, I think, again, it's really kind of based upon relationships and the relationships that you have with your donors and members. And, you know, those are very important to us here at the task force. And, you know, it can be slightly more challenging because so much of the election sucks up so much of the energy and the airwaves. But on the flip side of that, when there's a candidate or there's a ballot measure that is particularly awful toward LGBT people,
yeah,
it energizes our folks, right? Not only do they want to give more, they want to volunteer more. They want to, you know, not only engage at the national level with an organization like the task force, but they want to be right there in the fight with their local or statewide organization, especially if they're facing a ballot measure. And, you know, there is a clear distinction this year, unlike you know, other presidential election years where there is a candidate who is pro-marriage equality and there's a candidate who's not.
Yeah.
And that hasn't been the case in a long time, actually ever.
Right.
In a presidential election. So, you know, so I think our folks, our activist leaders and organizers around the country are fired up not only to beat back these anti-gay ballot measures that are happening in a few states, but also to make sure that we continue to move the equality agenda forward. And that, you know, it's not only about LGBT people, but it's about social justice, that we don't leave anybody behind.
Right.
You know, one of the unique things about the task force that I think sets us apart from other organizations is we have a much wider worldview, and that, you know, a lot of times we get criticized for, well, why don't you just work on marriage? Isn't that the most important issue? Well, marriage is important, but, you know, as our transgender study proved, transgender people and especially transgender people of color face huge amounts of discrimination that we need to be concerned about, that are connected not only because of their gender identity or expression, but because they're people of color, right? Or they're
right.
from a working class background, or they're disabled. And so we have a responsibility to make sure that, you know, we're not only fighting for the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, but we're fighting for the rights of all people to be able to live their lives without discrimination, without fear, and to live their lives openly and honestly. The same folks that are behind ballot measures that want to restrict the rights of LGBT people, or that are behind marriage ballot measures that define marriage as between one man and one woman, are the same people that want English-only laws, or that are anti-immigrant or anti-affirmative action, or want to roll back a woman's right to choose.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the same enemy, and we need to come together. And as a task force, we work across all of those issues to make sure that we are building the strongest possible force for freedom that we can imagine, and that we care about all of those issues. Because when we're able to work on all of those things, we move forward all together.
And that is the goal. That is the goal. Now, where can folks go to learn about the cool things you're doing?
Well, you can go to our website at thetaskforce.org. You can also check us out on Facebook. You can do a search for the task force or the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and like us on Facebook. For those folks that are really interested in coming to the Creating Change Conference, which is going to be in January 23rd through 27th, 2013, in Atlanta, Georgia, they can go to creatingchange.org and get all that info. The registration will open in September, but right now there's plenty of info up there about the hotel and submitting a proposal for a workshop. So if folks are interested in doing that, they can go to creatingchange.org. hattocreategay.org, and I hope to see everyone, including you, Ken.
Well, I'll be at the How to Create a Gay podcast session.
In Atlanta, Georgia.
That would be great. That would be great. All right, so I will, after this call, I'll just get you my list of friends and family. You will hit them up for donations. I'm really excited about that. Whatever,
excellent.
You know, I want it to be consistent with my tone, so whatever that may be, you figure that out. And additionally, if you want to hit up people who want to leave a legacy gift, that's fine, too.
Oh, excellent.
That's fine, too. Use
all
your
skills.
We
like legacy gifts at the task force,
too. Yes, I just read that. Well, Russell, I must say, you're doing some pretty cool things, and it sounds like, which I love, you like your job.
I love my job. It is a joy to come to work every day, and as I often remind my colleagues here at the task force, we are all in a very privileged position because we get paid to do this work, and so many of the people that come to Creating Change that we work with out in the field are volunteering their time,
yeah.
And that you know, it's our job at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force to make sure that we're supporting those folks and making sure that they have the skills that they need to succeed.
Huge.
So it's
huge.
A pleasure every day to come to work.
Russell, well, it's an absolute pleasure knowing that you are doing this work on everyone's behalf. So I will see you in Atlanta in January. I'm saying it on the air right now. I have to make it so.
Excellent.
All right.
I'll hold you to it.
Keep doing what you do. And I should say, I'm not kidding you. I sent someone, they said, who's on the show this week? I told them who's on the show, and they looked you up. They said, he might be married to Wilson Cruz. So I'm just saying that there's some...
Somebody saw our Facebook picture. So Wilson Cruz is my best friend in the whole world.
I'm just saying.
And we were at a conference together a couple of weeks ago where Wilson received an award, and... we took a picture together there, and it does look like a wedding photo. So I will tell him that. He will get great joy out of that.
There's a picture of you guys with him winning an award. There's you guys climbing the Eiffel Tower. There's you guys with the pyramids. It's enough already with you and Wilson Cruz. Just saying. Russell, please keep doing what you're doing. It is so hugely important. Thank you. All right, folks, that about wraps things up for this week's episode. Hey, there is still a little bit of time left. If you want to donate $5 in our Guaranteed to Win This Show Is So Gay raffle, you could win prizes donated by past This Show Is So Gay guests, including CDs, DVDs, books, tons of different things. Go on over to thisshowisogay.com. Right there on our homepage, there's a link. It's only $5 to enter the raffle, and you are guaranteed to win something. All the money goes to Charity Treks, which is the big 415-mile bike ride that I am doing just next week. Holy cow. From Burlington, Vermont to Portland, Maine, and they are raising money to find a cure for HIV and AIDS. We don't have any time left for this week's episode, so get out there, folks. Go write your first sermon. Go deliver your 100th sermon. Register for Creating Change. Do whatever it is that you do to raise up the voices of all of our brothers and sisters around us. And while you're doing it, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?